Okay, we are now recording.
There we are.
Mark, you want to do them or you want me to take them?
No, you go ahead. We'll just do it as we normally do.
Okay, well, welcome everybody. Hugh, we've got a good question from Doug McComb here in Monrovia. As always, he asks good questions. He says, what would you say are the specific things in astronomy and astrophysics that have been used to determine the age of the universe to be close to 13.79 billion years old? Also, how old is the Milky Way?
Okay, good questions. And you know, a lot of lay people think we use radiometric dating to date the age of the universe. And that is a useful tool, but we have many other tools that are considerably more accurate than radiometric dating. The two that are favored by astronomers are the maps of the cosmic background radiation, the sizes of the hot and cold spots in the maps of the radiation left orbit cosmic creation event give you an accurate age for the universe that comes in at 13.79 billion years. The other method that's almost as good in giving you an age for the universe is looking at the cosmic expansion rates throughout all of cosmic history. They're not strictly constant, but they're constant to within about 1%. In fact, Big Bang creation models predict that the universe will expand slightly more rapidly currently than it did in the early years of the history of the universe. But that particular method gives you a date for the age of the universe that's consistent with the date that you get from maps of the cosmic background radiation. And probably the Sloan Digital Sky Survey has been the best database for getting an accurate age estimate for the universe. Now, if you want the details, I cover the best methods, the 6 to 8 best methods for measuring the age of the universe in the Crater in the Cosmos 4th edition. But what's remarkable is that given how independent these methods are, they all give you the same date for the age of the universe. And by the way, the age we get from radiometric dating also is consistent with the other methods that we have. Now, as far as the age of our Milky Way galaxy, our best measurements tell us that it formed about 1 billion years after the birth of the universe. So about almost 13 billion years ago, the Milky Way galaxy forms, and it grows in its first 3 billion years. But the last time it had a major accretion event where it merged with a significantly sized galaxy, like a large dwarf galaxy, was 10.5 billion years ago. That's when it merged with two relatively large dwarf galaxies. But that's the last time that has happened, and is one reason why our Milky Way galaxy has such extraordinary symmetrical and stable spiral arms. Because yeah, when you do accrete a large galaxy, it will disturb the structure of the galaxy. And we don't know of any other spiral galaxy that we can observe in the entire universe that it has had stable spiral arms for that length of a period of time.
Thank you, Hugh. The next question is from Stephen Posta in Spring, Texas. He asks, since the moon is tidally locked to the Earth, the far side of the moon is always facing the vastness of open space. With the Earth blocking the near side of the moon, how is it possible for objects to impact the moon's near side surface and leave a crater that appears to be perpendicular to the near side surface?
Okay, good question. Number one, the moon has not always been tidally locked. And so when it wasn't tidally locked, you're going to get bombardments on the near surface as well as on the far side. But if you actually look at photo images of the far side of the moon, you'll see that it's much more cratered than the side that faces the Earth. And so the fact that it is tidally locked has impacted the cratering features of the far side relative to the near side. The other thing we noticed through observations is the crater features on the near side, on the side of the face of the Earth, are much older on average than the ones we see on the side that faces away from the Earth. The other thing that's important is that even though the moon is tidally locked, because of the gravitational influences of the sun and the earth, there's a little bit of a wiggle in that tidal locking. And so, for example, from Earth-based telescopes, we can see 59% of the surface of the moon. And so the fact that we get that little slight wobbling away from perfect tidal locking means that you can get some crater events happening that way.
I think his question, though, has to do with how is it an object could hit the front side of the moon at seemingly 90 degrees to the surface, which would have made it almost like it was coming from Earth.
Right. Well, I mean, you can still get collision events even in the center part of the moon that faces us. And that's because, you know, you get an asteroid or a comet coming in towards the Earth-Moon system. It's experiencing the influence of the gravity of the Earth, the gravity of the Moon, the gravity of the Sun, the gravity of Jupiter and Saturn. And it can yield rather complex dynamics in the collision path of the asteroid or the comet. The probability of it hitting in the center of the face, the part of the Moon facing the Earth, is much lower than it is on the far side, but it can happen because of these complex gravitational interactions. I mean, usually when you do these kinds of collision problems, you look at it from a two-body problem. Or a two-body problem, you can solve the dynamics of the collision quite precisely. But once you bring in a third body, a fourth body, a fifth body, now you get solutions that are extremely complex.
Mm-hmm.
So that explains why that happens. But Doug is right. You're going to get much more frequent collision events on the far side than you will on the near side.
John Belling asks us, asks you, I was wondering what your thoughts are on the recent Venus and Jupiter alignment. I was researching into the actual birth of Christ and wondering whether the actual birth was not during the winter time. So this would invalidate this astronomical alignment as the star for Jesus during that first Christmas. Also, what do you think the star was 2,000 years ago? Was it a miracle of God, kind of like the burning bush and the pillar of fire that Moses witnessed?
Yeah, you'll find articles I've written on our website. They're hard to find. What I've done is I've provided links to those articles on my Facebook page. December 10th, I provided links to what I consider to be the best articles I've written on the Christmas star. And more recently than that, I had an interview on the Christmas star. And it was on, Cerebral Apologetics, I think was the site, but I provided a link. Before Christmas, I gave that link. And that's where I had the most detailed interview on the Christmas star. And what was good is the moderator pushed back on me on the various explanations I gave. And so it's the most comprehensive interview I've done on the Christmas star. But you'll find all the links on my Facebook page. And all you need to do is go to Facebook Hugh Ross or Hugh Ross Facebook. It'll take you right there. You can scroll through and you'll get those links. But the bottom line is I argue in the articles and in the podcast that the Christmas star cannot be a conjunction of planets for several reasons. Number one, Matthew 2 tells us it's a single star, not two. A conjunction by definition is two planets coming close together in the sky, or one of the planets coming close to a star in the sky, like a bright star or the moon. But in each case, you've got two objects, and you note that it's a single object recorded there. The other thing is that this event does not show up in any astronomical records outside of what we see in the Bible. You also notice in Matthew 2 that the religious leaders in Jerusalem and King Herod were mystified about the star that the wise men were talking about. And this tells us that it had to be a subtle event. Otherwise, they would have known about it. And I think we need to put ourselves in the context of 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, you didn't have city lights, and you didn't have all this light pollution. People were well aware of what was going on in the heavens. And so, and they carefully noted bright comets, supernova eruptions, conjunctions of planets. So the fact that we see that Herod and the religious leaders were mystified tells us that it couldn't be a conjunction of planets. The other thing you see in Matthew 2 is it says that the star appeared to them while they were in the east. And after they made their journey to Jerusalem, it disappeared when they were back in the east, but they made their journey to Jerusalem. And while they were on their way from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, the star reappeared. And Matthew 2 tells us that King Herod carefully questioned the Magi as to when they saw the star in the east. And so that gives us an approximate time separation between the first appearance of the star and the second appearance, based on the fact that when the wise men did not return to King Herod, but went back to the land, King Herod used the date that the Magi had given him for when they saw the star in the east to determine, okay, I'm going to put to death every firstborn son in the village of Bethlehem as 2 years of age or younger, which tells us that the separation between the first appearance of the star and the second appearance was probably something in the neighborhood of a year and a half. And I argue in the articles I've written that eliminates all possibilities. I mean, it's got to be faint enough that only the wise men would have seen it, and it wouldn't have been recorded in the Egyptian or the Greek or the Roman or the Egyptian or from the Babylonian or Chinese or Japanese astronomical records. And therefore, I believe it's a recurring nova or a cataclysmic variable star. In both cases, it would be sufficiently faint that it wouldn't show up in these astronomical records and has a capability of reappearing about a year and a half later at approximately the same brightness of the first one. A recurring nova, I think, is a stronger bet because the second appearance could be the same as the first appearance, whereas with a cataclysmic variable star, it's rare that the second eruption of the star would be as bright as the first. And in both the interview and the article, I explain how it is that you can get a recurring event like that. It's what happens when you've got a star that's gone through all of its nuclear burning, but is orbited by a second star that hasn't yet gone through all of its orbital burning, where the dying star is more massive than the star that's still burning and close enough where it's stealing mass. So what happens is the star that's burnt out is accumulating mass from the other, from its partner star. And when it accumulates enough mass, it undergoes an explosion. And then it consumes it all and dies away. You can't see it anymore, but it continues to accumulate mass, and you can get a second explosion, a third explosion, etc. So anyway, just look for those links and you'll get all the details. I also cite observations of recent recurring nova that have recurrence periods under 2 years. In fact, they found one that's even under a year, because that used to be the major pushback. We haven't seen any recurring nova with a time separation of less than 10 years. That was a comment made 30 years ago, but now we've seen several recurring nova with periods under 2 years.
Well, it's 10:45, Hugh. Do you want to go ahead and get started with your lesson?
Yeah, I will. And it's a good segue because I'm going to begin. Well, let me first share screen. Okay, well, welcome all of you to the Paradoxes class. We always begin with about 15 minutes of Q&A. We'll have another Q&A session after I finish my teaching. Well, let me open our time in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this day that you've given us. every day you give us is a gift from you, and help us to rejoice in that. And Father, I pray that you give us all the humility and the grace that we can receive more of your love and life and truth. We pray for a good discussion in this class, Lord. And Lord, that what happens here would cause all of us to draw closer to you. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, Merry Christmas to all of you, and looking forward to a better 2021 than 2020. We were just talking about the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. By the way, this is the URL that all of you are going to need to get into the meeting that will follow the webinar, where we all turn on our cameras and microphones and get into the discussion questions. And I'll show this URL again. It's the same URL we've been using for the past couple of months. But yes, I just finished answering a question about the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that occurred on December 21st. Actually, they were quite close on December 20th as well. And it's the closest conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn that has occurred since the early 1600s. And what's special is that this is Jupiter and Saturn coming close enough together in the sky that their moon systems will appear to overlap one another when you look at them through a pair of binoculars or a telescope. So as they were beginning to get close together, I alerted people on both my Twitter and Facebook page, hey, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's actually a once-in-a-millennium opportunity. You say, well, you know, I missed this one. When's the next one going to happen? Well, you're going to have to wait about 600 more years before it's going to happen again. But what I did is I actually took some photographs of this conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn through my telescope. My telescope's not really designed for astrophotography, but I found a way to make it work. And so I'm going to actually show you some of the photos I took. And let's begin with this one. Yeah, this is the one I took on December 20th. And my goal was to show the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So that explains why the images of Jupiter and Saturn are overexposed. And so you can see the ring system there of Saturn above Jupiter. Because it's overexposed, there's no separation of the rings with the planet. You can see the four bright moons of Jupiter. It looks like there's five moons, the smaller of the five dots is actually a background star. So it's not one of the moons of Jupiter, but you can see the four big moons of Jupiter there. And you can actually see two moons of Saturn. And so the faint bright spot that you see just to the left of Saturn is the moon Titan. It's the same size as the moons of the big moons of Jupiter, actually a little larger, except for Ganymede. But if you actually look carefully, above and slightly to the right and about half the distance of Titan to Saturn, you'll see the other bright moon of Saturn, Rhea. Now, both Jupiter and Saturn have got more than 60 moons, but these are the ones that are easiest to see. In fact, if you've got a good pair of binoculars, you can see all six of these moons through a pair of binoculars. But the whole point is, this shows even on December 20th, Jupiter and Saturn were close enough together that the moon systems, the sizes of them were bigger than the separation of Jupiter and Saturn. And here's where I took a less exposed image. And in this case, you can't see Titan and Rhea. You can still faintly see the four bright moons of Jupiter, but this actually shows you the ring system of Saturn. That shows you an intact ring system there. And then the following evening, I took some photos, and here you got Jupiter and Saturn closer together, and three of the moons of Jupiter are visible. The fourth moon was also visible, but it's actually below. So I had this magnified to the point where you could only see three of the moons of Jupiter. And of course, to pick up the moons, I had to overexpose the images of Jupiter and Saturn. But look where Titan is. If you look about halfway between Jupiter and Saturn and up a little bit, you see the moon Titan. And so Titan is actually appearing on the sky, a little bit closer to Jupiter, well, about the same distance to Jupiter as is from Saturn. And if you look to the left, slightly left of Saturn, you can see the moon Rhea. So this really shows you the overlap of the moon systems. And I was also able to get a photo at lower exposure where you can see the rings of Saturn relative to Jupiter. And I thought it'd be fun too to take a photo of Albireo. You say, what's Albireo? It's a double star that's at the base of the Northern Cross. Cygnus or the Swan is a constellation. And what's wonderful about that double star is the color contrast. One star is a deep blue color, almost a turquoise color, and the brighter star is a gold color. And it's very easy to see in any pair of binoculars. So you can look at it tonight and enjoy that one. It's probably the easiest deep sky object to look at. So I just thought I'd begin the class by showing you these photos. And if you go to my Facebook page, people with better astrophotography telescopes than I have posted some photos. So you can check those out. And hey, if you missed it, well, another 600 years from now, they're going to be that close again. So you can enjoy that. All right. My colleague, Fazal Rana, this is the science component. I really appreciate the feedback I've been getting from all of you. People have been telling me their favorite part of the class is where I begin the teaching time with some focus on a new scientific discovery. Then we jump into a class, then we do Q&A, and then we get involved with one another discussing some questions that I pose. But my colleague, Fazal Rana, last week, he read over 100 research articles. I think it was like 200 research articles he read on these vaccines that are being developed to help us with COVID-19 or the SARS-2 virus. And basically is making the point that we're actually seeing nothing short of a miracle and what's happening with this pandemic. And so the point he makes is that there are many diseases, even today, where we don't have a vaccine. So a vaccine is not an automatic thing that you can develop when you're faced with a disease. Many challenging diseases, diseases that cause death, we have no vaccine. But the average time it takes to produce a vaccine is 7 years. And until recently, the fastest production time was 4 years. But in terms of developing a vaccine for SARS-2, here's a miracle. It happened in just 11 months. Able to come up with a safe, effective vaccine in just 11 months. And the people developing the vaccines were quite shocked at how effective they were. You know, we consider a vaccine to be very effective if it gives protection from any kind of side effects or infection or noticeable symptoms for 70% of the people who get the vaccine. The other 30%, they will get a mild case. And but in this case, we're getting 95%. So the vaccines are more productive than the older vaccines. And mainly what Fuzz has written about, he's done a podcast that you can find. And actually, I've provided links on my Facebook and Twitter page to both the podcast he did on the miracle of the vaccines we've been coming up with for COVID-19. And he's also produced a really, a fairly lengthy article, in-depth article on the hundreds of papers he read that basically document the miraculous nature of these SARS-2 vaccines. And what makes them so effective is that they're not your typical vaccines. These are messenger RNA vaccines. And so this is the first time that a messenger RNA vaccine has ever been developed and employed. And the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, it's the first messenger RNA vaccines to be safely and effectively used on humans. And there's several other pharmaceutical companies poised to bring out their own versions of a messenger RNA vaccine for the SARS-2 virus. Okay, let me get back here. Okay, messenger RNA is a single-stranded molecule. So it's different from DNA. DNA is a double-stranded molecule, long molecule. Messenger RNA is a single-stranded molecule that carries a sequence of a gene, which is read by a ribosome to synthesize a protein. And so you can think of it as like a hard drive, in the sense that it carries the codes that gives you the sequence of the gene. And what a gene does is many of the genes that will give you a map whereby a ribosome can synthesize a protein. Okay, here we go. Sorry. And how the vaccine works, uses messenger RNA to go after a key viral protein fragment to the immune system, triggering a response that leads to production of antibodies against the viral protein. So it doesn't target the entire virus. It targets a key protein in the virus and basically stimulates the immune response system in every human body to produce all these antibodies that are designed to target that key protein, disable that key protein, and enable and prevent the viruses from penetrating into a whole lot of cells inside your body. Okay, here we go. So the ones that it's targeting are the what are called the spike proteins. You've probably heard this term about the spike protein. It's basically these little red spikes that you see above the SARS-2 virus that actually enables the virus to attach itself to a shell, to a cell, penetrate the cell, and force the cell to reproduce more of these viruses and ends up killing the cell. And so the messenger RNA is basically designed to disable these spike proteins from doing their thing, which prevents the infection from happening here. Okay, the spike proteins, as I've already mentioned, they play the central role in the binding and the entry of the virus into the host cell. And a vaccine, this is what's amazing about messenger RNA vaccines. You can develop a vaccine for any infectious disease by creating and inserting the right messenger RNA sequence for that disease into the vaccine. Now, what it requires is you have to be able to map the genome of the virus. But that's something that's now routine in biochemistry. Genome mapping was something that was developed several years ago. And so it's now possible for labs around the world to, you know, get a virus and literally within weeks, they're able to map the complete genome sequence of that virus. And then they look for a key protein, a protein that they can target, and they can design a messenger RNA that will target that key protein and disable these viruses from doing any significant damage. And so we now have the technology where we can deal with any viral disease by simply mapping the genome of the virus and then designing and creating a specific messenger RNA that will disable these viruses. The key technological difficulty is actually finding a way to get the messenger RNA into the immune response cells of the body. But that was kind of a breakthrough that's been happening at both Moderna and Pfizer, is finding ways to deliver not just a few, but a whole lot of these messenger RNAs and basically saturating the T cells, the immune response cells within the human body and equipping them to produce the antibodies that would be effective. Now, I made a post on my Facebook page basically saying just how beneficial these viruses are, or these messenger RNA vaccines are. And I was surprised by the response I got. I was a bit naive at just how many anti-vaxxers are out there, how much fear there is about this COVID-19 vaccine, how many people think that there's a government conspiracy involved, or that the pharmaceuticals are just in it for the money, and Big Brother is going to put a chip inside the vaccine and use that as a way to control the population of the world. These are some of the conspiracy theories that are out there. And it basically demonstrates how little knowledge the general public has right now about messenger RNA vaccines. And so what I've done is actually create some slides here just showing how safe these messenger RNA vaccines are. One of the reasons why biochemists began to explore the development of messenger RNA vaccines is they realized that if they could actually develop these vaccines, they would be much, much safer than the vaccines we've been using up to this date. I mean, for example, we've been able to eradicate smallpox by vaccinating the world's population. And the way that worked is you came up with a vaccine where you had disabled or weakened versions of the virus. And so the body would respond to that and be able to deal with the stronger versions. But the big advantage of RNA vaccines, so previous vaccines, they basically injected inactivated or attenuated viruses. So basically giving the body an opportunity to respond to weakened versions of the virus, and that equipped them to deal with the stronger versions. However, that meant that there was an infection risk. You could have humans, for example, that got inoculated, and because their immune response was so weakened, even the inactivated or attenuated viruses caused them problems. Now, it's a very, very tiny percentage of the population that's in that category, sometimes on the order of 1 in 1 million, or 100,000, but it explains why you get these adverse cases. But the advantage of the messenger RNA vaccines is there's a total absence of viruses in the vaccine. You're basically giving people a messenger RNA. So there's zero risk that you're gonna be infected by the vaccine, because there is no virus in the vaccine. And likewise, there's no risk for the production workers. I mean, you've got all these people that have to produce the vaccines, and if they're working with inactivated or attenuated viruses, well, first of all, they got to somehow weaken the virus, and the process of weakening the virus, they could get exposed to the stronger versions of the virus. And in previous vaccines, there's been many examples of the vaccine production workers, getting infected and having disease consequences as a result. Now with this messenger RNA vaccine, you literally can put the workers at rest. They have no risk of being infected by being produced. The messenger RNA gets out in the lab, it's not gonna harm anybody. And so it's safer for the people getting the vaccine, and it's safer for the people producing the vaccine. And you can actually design the vaccine to make it even safer. Namely, you incorporate non-natural nucleotides into the messenger RNA. And so these are additional nucleotides that they put into the messenger RNA that don't really help the vaccine be more effective. But what it does is it minimizes adverse immune responses. And what we're targeting here are people like, think of an example of a person with a peanut allergy. Most of us are not allergic to peanuts, But there are people who are severely allergic to those peanuts. Likewise, there's a problem when you inject anything into the human body that you can get a few individuals that will have a severe allergic reaction. But what both Moderna and Pfizer have been able to do is find ways of augmenting the messenger RNA to very substantially minimize the possibility of these allergic responses to the injection. The other thing they've been able to do is to incorporate non-natural lipids into the messenger RNA, and they discovered through the research it has two benefits. Number one, it minimizes the adverse immune responses. At the same time, it stabilizes messenger RNA. And that was a big problem. One reason why it did take 11 months is it took a long time to find ways to keep the messenger RNA stable enough for a long enough period that it could be effective in stimulating the immune response system to protect you against infection from the SARS-2. And so this has been a big technological breakthrough as a consequence of what's been happening. Now, you've probably heard of Operation Warp Speed. Not very many people have heard of Operation Light Speed. And this was a term that Pfizer came up with. And basically what I'm going to do is just show you the miraculous nature of the timing of these vaccines. Back in 1990, messenger RNA was discovered within the scientific community to be an effective delivery into the human immune system, human immune response system, to stimulate the production of these antibodies. And so back in 1990, scientists proposed, hey, this could be an effective vaccination tool. However, the technological challenges were truly enormous. But what happened as soon as this was announced in 1990, you had pharmaceuticals and government research labs and other researchers beginning to develop. And the potential of these vaccines was fully appreciated even back in 1990, saying, hey, this could be much safer, far more effective. We're not just going to get a 70% response. We can get above 90%. And so what happened is that 30 years of painstaking, diligent research, mainly by the pharmaceutical companies, the research teams at the pharmaceuticals, brought messenger RNA vaccine technology to the threshold of working. And you're probably aware that November 2019 is when we had the first evidence for SARS-2 breakout. That date, November 2019, is the same date as when they finally figured out a way how they could use messenger RNA in a safe manner to bring out an effective vaccine. So it took 30 years. And I don't think this is something that Buzz Rana was able to document in all the research papers he read. He said it was remarkable is how back in 1990, these researchers realized the potential of messenger RNA for effective vaccines and immediately began a very diligent and painstaking and costly research effort to bring it to the forefront. But even so, it took 30 whole years to finally get past all the technological difficulties. A lot of it had to do with the application of nanotechnology to be able to design the messenger RNA, nanotechnology to find a way to deliver it into the human body. That's what took most of the research effort. But it culminated, it finally got completed in November of 2019. So that's the remarkable nature of this. Everything was in place in November 2019 to bring about this vaccine. And actually, what was interesting, if you go back to 2018, people were saying, well, you know, when we finally get to the point where we have the vaccine technology all in place, we're going to need a disease that we can develop with it. And of course, they were hoping for a mild disease that they could use to bring up the first vaccine. But then we got struck with SARS-2, not a mild disease, but a really deadly disease, a highly infectious disease. And so that's what prompted the effort. to say, okay, now that we've got the technology, and it was Pfizer that said, okay, we're going to launch this. And what happened was in December of 2019, Chinese scientists, that's where SARS-2 first broke out, within a month, they had identified the SARS-2 virus. And within a few weeks after that, these same Chinese scientists determined the structure of the SARS-2 genes. They basically mapped the genome of the SARS-2 virus, including the genes that code for the spike proteins. And they published all of their details on the internet. I mean, the internet is something that took years to develop. And right now, the internet is set up in such a way that scientists, when they see something really crucial, they can actually publish online immediately before it goes into a peer-reviewed journal and make it available to the entire world for free. That's what happened. That's now routine amongst scientists today, that if there's something they consider to be particularly important and timely, they can publish it on the internet. And so they actually published the entire map of the virus gene sequences, including in particular the spike protein. And was not known by too many people, including scientists, is that the very moment that this got published on the internet, that's when Pfizer launched Operation Lightspeed. And it's actually less than 10 minutes. Within minutes after the internet release, scientists of Pfizer and BioNTech, their partner in Europe, began designing messenger RNA vaccines for SARS-2, launching Operation Lightspeed. The effort actually got launched within minutes after the internet release. They had the technology in place, thanks to those 30 years of research, and they said, we're gonna go for it right off the bat. And so they jumped on it. Major effort involving many, many scientists began immediately to begin to design a messenger RNA vaccine with a hope that they could bring it out in a whole lot less than 4 years. And in April 2020, the US federal government launched Operation Warp Speed, which more people have heard of. And Operation Warp Speed, let me get my computers up here. This was a partnership between government agencies and private pharmaceuticals. It's an unprecedented partner. You got to go back to World War II before you find a similar grand organized partnership between private corporations and the government agencies working together to basically deal with a crisis and to deal with it as effectively and as rapidly as possible. And the government agencies were involved were the National Institute of Health, the CDC, the FDA, BARDA. I've never heard of BARDA. That's the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. The Department of Defense got involved in this, as well as the Department of Agriculture and Veterans Affairs. And so all these different, and that, there were other departments involved as well, but these are the main ones that were involved. And they actually appointed a general from the Department of Defense to manage all these different government agencies and to work with the private pharmaceuticals. And the federal government basically subsidized $18 billion of research and technology development as part of the CARES Act. The CARES Act was above $1 trillion, but they set aside $18 billion. Scientists now look at this and said, you know, maybe it would have been wiser to invest more than $18 billion, but this was unprecedented at the time that $18 billion would be taken out of the federal government and basically used to subsidize private research corporations to speed up the development and effectiveness of the vaccine. And it was referred to as, we're gonna spend billions to save trillions. I think that's something we've all learned from this pandemic, is that indeed, the cost of this pandemic has been enormous. A lot of people have been furloughed, they're out of work. The government has to step in with the subsidies and just the cost of trying to do business. It literally is costing the world economy trillions of dollars. In fact, it's been estimated that it's north of $1 trillion per month that this virus is costing us. So on that basis, spending a few billion to ensure that we get the economy back to where it was and the health of the human population back to where it was within a year rather than 7 years or 4 years. In that sense, it just made very good economic sense. What was interesting, though, is that Pfizer that launched Operation Lightspeed within minutes after they had the sequence for the virus genome, they said, we're not going to take any government funding. They declined Warp Speed funding, and this is what they said in their public announcement. The reason we're going to decline the funding is, quote, to liberate our scientists from any bureaucracy that comes with having to give reports and agree to how we're going to spend the money in parallel or together. And basically, you know, Pfizer obviously is a really big pharmaceutical, and their comment was, if we take government money, it's going to slow us down. You know, we're just going to decline the money and we're going to go full bore in getting this out as fast as possible. And indeed, they were the first pharmaceutical to bring out a safe, effective virus. And they credit it with the fact that they didn't have to give reports or deal with the politicians or with government leaders. They just said, we're just going to go for it as we can. However, they did have the promise that the U.S. government would purchase 50 million vaccines. So once you get something developed, we will, for $40 a vaccine, we'll purchase 50 million. So at least Pfizer had the promise that if they were successful, they were going to be able to get $2 billion for 50 million vaccinations that they would produce. And I say 50 million, actually read the fine print, it's 100 million. But as we all know, the Pfizer vaccine requires 3 weeks apart. And so it basically would service 50 million human beings. And Pfizer, basically, because they didn't have any government limitations on them, they actually signed a contract to sell 100 million vaccinations to the European Union and an undisclosed number to the United Kingdom. So actually, they're doing more business in Europe than they are doing in the United States. And this is something else you may not be aware of, but part of Operation Warp Speed is that $1 billion is for order 300 million University of Oxford AstraZeneca vaccinations on the condition of the vaccination they produce would prove effective and safe. And so they basically made a deal with a smaller pharmaceutical that said, okay, we're gonna give 2 billion to Pfizer for 50 million inoculations, of a 1 billion to AstraZeneca for 300 million, which would basically take care of the entire human population. As you're probably aware, the University of Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is not yet ready, although there's some talk that it could be ready literally within just a few weeks. In that case, everything is set for every member of the U.S. Population to be vaccinated. So how much time? I got 5 minutes to get things set up. What I'm going to do, this is the URL you're going to need to get into our meeting after we're done with the webinar. But I want to feature a couple of the testimonies we've lined up. What I've been doing the past few weeks is we've been looking at these passages in the epistles, the New Testament epistles, on how we who are followers of Jesus Christ should respond to the suffering that God graciously allows us to experience. I say graciously because God intends that we do go through suffering, but it'll be suffering that would bring us pure joy, as it says in James 1, and would bring us fulfillments in the sense that we would see unbelievable good coming from whatever suffering we go through. One passage we've been looking at is Romans 8:28, which makes the point, in all things God works for the good for those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. This is a guarantee. This will happen to anyone who loves God and has been called according to the purpose that God has put in his or her life. And we've been had numbers of you giving you testimonies that effect. I gave one to myself. And we're going to have that. And I've asked Mel Peters and Norm Higgleson to each give their story of how Romans 8:28 has been manifested in their life. And next week, we're going to have Keith Wilson and Tonette Carroll give a talk. And incidentally, if you prefer to do one of Philippians 1:12, which is basically a verse, let me see if I got that. No, I won't go there. I just want to get straight to these testimonies because of the time we've been taking here. So I'm going to ask you, Ross and Mark, could you promote Mel Peters and Norm Higgleson to be participants? Because that way they can take on their camera and put on their microphone.
If you care that.
And meanwhile, I'm going to stop the share feature.
So that was Mel Peters, right?
Mel Peters and Norm Higgleson. And let me see if I can find them.
I think I have them both up now.
Okay, good. Thank you. Yep, I see them. Okay, Mel and Norm, can you turn on your microphone and your camera? It's towards the lower left. Whoever does it first, I'll feature first. There we go, Norm. Hey, you've got a beautiful background there. So you're in a beautiful spot. So Mel, I'll let you go first. And there's Norm, so thank you.
Okay, this is Laguna Beach. That's their virtual background. I had a major disruptive event in my life 30 years ago. It was a divorce of a 15-year marriage. It came as a complete surprise. The doorbell rang one early morning, 6 o'clock. So I go to the front door and they say, "Are you Mr. Peters?" I said, "Yes." So they handled me some legal papers. And I was an attorney. I'm retired now. So I was used to seeing legal papers all the time. So I thought maybe it had something to do with one of my cases. So then I looked down on it and had my name on it, had my wife's name on it. And I couldn't believe it. I kept reading it. And then it said something, dissolution. So I go back in the bedroom, wake up my wife. I said, "What is this?" And she just was so hostile. This came as a complete surprise. We had some problems that I thought a lot of couples do. We had, and we had gone to counseling, but there was never any talk about divorce. And she said she wouldn't talk to me, that I had to get out of the house, that if I needed to communicate anything, talk to her attorney. So I had to hire an attorney. That attorney talked to her attorney, but couldn't get any response to her. I said, "Let's just settle it. Let's just split everything. We didn't have any kids. There's no sense going to a trial. Let's save attorney's fees." But my wife just didn't cooperate with her attorney. So we had to go to trial, went to trial. Just before the trial, my wife quit her job. So the trial ended up, the judge gave her the house. I had been making payments on it for 3 years because she didn't have a job. I didn't want the house to foreclose. My attorney says you're entitled to half of the reimbursement for that. I didn't get that. She got the house. I had to pay her attorney's fees. I had to pay my attorney's fees. I had to pay her spousal support for 2 years. I had to pay the credit card debts that she racked up. So it just ruined me financially. I was about $60,000 in debt. So I rented a room from a lady for $300 a month. And I didn't, that was a godsend. It was kind of depressing to just go from being married in a house to just renting a room. But it enabled me to pay off my debts. And I lived there for the next about 6 years. And I was able to pay off all the debts. And, but it threw me into my emotions completely overwhelmed me. I was depressed. I had anxiety attacks. I had no appetite. So I had all the classic symptoms of trauma, went to counseling. And the therapist says, well, you need to see a psychiatrist because there's no need for you to go through this pain. I could hardly sleep. I would wake up with cold sweats. I was probably sleeping maybe a couple hours a night. I was just like wired, was just exhausted from not getting enough sleep. I wasn't eating properly. And so the psychiatrist gave me Prozac for depression, gave me Xanax for panic attacks, gave me sleeping pills to sleep. So I started taking these drugs and it knocked out my memory. So I would make phone calls in the morning and in the afternoon, I could remember if I had called this person or not. So I'm practicing law and it's pretty dangerous. So I was kind of ashamed and embarrassed. I told my secretary, I said, I need to talk. Can you come in my office? And she says, yeah, I know you haven't been yourself. And I've seen your post-its everywhere, all over your desk, your office, the files. I had this phone call at this time with so-and-so, and this is what I said. So I figured it was the drugs. So I had an appointment with a psychiatrist, but I just started tapering down off the drugs. And when I saw the psychiatrist, he said, yeah, memory loss is one of the major side effects of Prozac. I said, why didn't you tell me? So I got off the drugs, and my secretary said, you know, that I saw in the newspaper, a Baptist church is giving us a divorce care ministry. You may be interested. And I said, yeah, I'd love to go. So I went to it, and it was a DVD series about, I don't know, 12 weeks. And every week it had a different topic. And it was a pastor that had gotten a divorce, and he used his experience for a ministry, which saved my life, because you watched the video and it talked about everything I was going through. And then they had Christian psychologists and psychiatrists talk about all of this. Then we broke into small groups and shared. And then I realized everybody in the group, most of them had it worse than I did. And just to hear their stories and to watch the DVDs. And then when the thing was over, my small group, I said, why don't we continue to meet? And we did. And let's just pray for each other until all of us get through the finalization of custody, court battles, and all of that. So the next 3 years, we all got together once a week, prayed for each other, supported each other. And through this, and I said, once I recover from this, if I ever do, this is something I want to do. I want to do a divorce care in church. And at the time of this divorce, I wasn't going to church. I never lost my faith. I had a strong intellectual faith. I'd always prayed. I grew up in the church and I always pray, why isn't Christ personal to me? I had an intellectual belief. I went to a Christian college, took a lot of elective theology classes, and went to seminary for 1 year. So I had a very strong belief on an intellectual level, but I never felt he had any care for me personally, never gave me any guidance, never answered any prayers. You know, when you go through college, you worry about what your career choice is or who to date, or who to marry. And you're praying for tests and stuff. And I envied people that gave testimonies. I said, why don't I feel, well, this divorce was an answer to prayer, because they say you never know how much you need Christ until he's all you got. And during my trauma and all my symptoms, I had nothing to turn to but Christ. And he came to me I just felt them 24 hours, and every chance I had Christian radio stations on. I listened to Christian music, and whenever I took walks or exercise, I was just praying the whole time. And I just asked for the Holy Spirit and Christ to sustain me, and he did. And I remember I was just driving on the freeway, and I just started singing, "What a Friend We Have in Jesus." And those words, I'd sang that since a child, but those words meant so much to me, that he was a friend. And we don't, and every time I went to him, he sustained me. So I did organize after several years, and I kind of got through this. Well, I got into singles, Christian singles life, found a church that had a good singles program. A lot of churches don't, they kind of neglect single adults. So I went to single retreats, single dances. I got on the computer dating, Christian singles groups. And I just heard a lot of stories. And one thing I learned, I used to have answers for everything. And I was kind of an analytical person and a lawyer. I just realized that didn't mean a whole lot. It was just listening to people, not having any answers, but just praying with them. And then I started a divorce care ministry, used those materials for about 5 years. And I got several other, I went to a pastor at a church. He says, "I don't know why we need that. We don't have any divorce people in our church." And I said, "Yeah, because they all leave, because they both go there and they're both embarrassed. And so one leaves or both leave." And I found a recovery ministry that did AA and groups like that. And he said, "Yeah, I'll sponsor you." So I got into the recovery ministries, and I realized there's a whole other life, almost an underground, because the churches don't really normally minister. And I found out that the recovery ministry, or people are just desperate for God. I said, "I want to use this as an outreach. I'm going to put ads in all the local papers. And hopefully we'll get non-Christians, people that are suffering, that just need a place to come, and for people to support them." So almost all of them were people that were not, were Christians, but maybe dropped out of the church. I got one Christian evangelist who went through a divorce, who had multiple affairs. He told his story. Everybody had a story. And I had a group of people that I had met in the singles groups that had gone through divorce. I asked them to help me facilitate. And one of the rules we had is, don't give advice, don't take sides. It was hard for them. Most of the women wanted to empathize with the women and talk about how bad their husbands were. And I said, "You can't do that. We haven't heard the other side of the story." So it really taught me that intellect, you know, is good for solving my legal cases and for even my religious belief that came through my head, but kind of it came through my heart. And the way I started to learn to relate to people is through heart to heart, to listen, to empathize. And the Lord, I could tell personally that the Lord really sustained me. You will survive this. And then over the years, colleagues and people that I worked with, you know, would be hit with a divorce, and he gave me a chance to give him my testimony. He said, "You won't believe it now, but you will get through this." And I found it drew me closer to God and the Lord, and I will be praying for you. And then people came back to me and said, "That meant so much, what you told me at the time. I didn't believe you, but it became true." And you don't know how much God and Christ means to you until that's all you have, but he will come through. And I realize probably I didn't feel like he answered my prayers, because I had such a good life. Once I start talking to people in the singles world, you meet a lot of hurt people that went through horrible childhoods, molestations, physical abuse. And I had it so good that the Lord really didn't. I mean, he was there through my family and my church and my Christian college and some good professors. So I looked at my life And I realized how grateful I was that I had it good. I didn't go through a lot of those traumas, but the trauma is what I needed. It was the worst thing that happened to me, but ended up being the best thing to happen to me. And a pastor told me, he said, God doesn't waste your pain, your shame, because there is shame attached to divorce. But he says, the point of our worst shame is really our most effective ministry. And I thought about that and I said, wow, you know, that I'm going to just share my shame, my pain. And it's not easy for us guys, especially attorneys, to say, you know, I was broken down as a person. I was completely, I had no control over my emotions. They took complete control over me. That's scary. And I did take drugs for a while, but that didn't work. It kind of makes things worse. So it was the church and the fellowship and the love. And church is a good healing place to be, and it brings a lot of love. So that's my testimony. I have another one, which I won't give, but I had a zigzag career path. And I thought I was just floundering. I went, you know, I was pre-med. I thought I'd get into med school. I didn't get into med school. I went to the PhD program in psychology, dropped out of there, went to seminary, dropped out of there. I was teaching high school, became a school administrator, ended up going to law school, and I did litigation, which I didn't like. I did that for about 4 years. And I finally got a job doing school law, just to make this brief. And when I got into school law, the major caseload was special education. So I was dealing with teachers, administrators, psychological reports, medical reports. So I brought in my psychology and, of course, my theology helped in just my life and my testimony. But I found the Lord used all those failures and dead ends and kind of a zigzag career path. And I could use all those different backgrounds that I had in my litigation. And I was doing pretty much litigation and special ed, and I was dealing with psychiatrists, medical doctors. And I had taught in juvenile hall, and that even helped, because the worst cases I had were kids in juvenile hall and abused and neglected kids that were part of the county foster care system. And those were the hardest cases. So the Lord works. It sometimes takes time to see it in our lives and how it works out. And when you see it, it's amazing.
Well, thank you, Mel. I really like the point that you made a couple of times that okay, we really don't know how much we need Christ until we got nothing else but Christ in our life. And that sometimes he's got to take us through trauma where we realize how much we need him, how much we should be appealing to him for our whole life, good and bad. So thank you for that emphasis. And also appreciate that going through the trauma you did got you into the ministry that God had planned for you since the beginning of the universe. I mean, here was this ministry out there. You weren't aware of it at the time. That took the trauma to get you into that just right place. And I love the fact that you ended your story, too, with all the different career pursuits that you were doing and how you wound up in a position where you needed all that background. I mean, who would have thought that you needed medical, administrative, teaching, law, but now you're in a spot where you can combine all of that. And it's something I've reminded my students of is that, you know, when I was going through and getting my education, I kept running into professors and said, we want you to take this course. And I kept looking and saying, you know, what on earth is that going to do to help me for my future career? That's just going to divert me. I really want to spend my time. I really want to take these courses and not that course. And they would overrule me and say, no, we're not going to let you take the courses you want to take. You got to take this course. And 10, 20 years later, I realized when they forced me to take a course that seemed to have no value for what I was pursuing and stopped me from taking the courses I wanted to take. Number one, the courses I wanted to take, I didn't have to. I was so highly motivated. I was going to educate myself anyway. And these courses I didn't want to take, there was content there and training that I really needed for where God wanted me to be 20, 30 years into the future. You know, you and I are both old enough, we can look back and say, all that trauma we went through, all that frustration we went through, there is a purpose behind each of it. And that's kind of what I want to bring out, these testimonies. Romans 8:28, often you don't see that over-surpassing good until a lot of years have gone by. Then you look back on it all and say, yeah, every bit of trauma I went through, every bit of frustration, God worked it all out for unimaginable good. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Norm. It's your turn.
Thank you, Hugh, and thank you, Mel, for that great.
I never knew that about Mel. Did you know that about Mel, Norm?
Not me. No, he's kept it well, pretty well hidden, actually.
Well, thank you, Mel. I really appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, I want to add
that I have a wonderful wife that beyond what I could have ever imagined. And I knew Norm when he lost his wife and found a new wife, and maybe we'll hear about that.
Yes. Well, I can start out. I'm going to start out where you left off. You have a wonderful wife. And that's where I'll start, because I do have a wonderful wife now. And this is my third one, actually. So that's part of the story also. I'd like to say that I've struggled quite a bit in trying to put this, what I was going to say, together, because I couldn't figure out what I had to say. But as I've gone through it, and I had to identify some things, so I think I do have some things to say, and that's what we all have to realize. We all have an important story to tell. I didn't know, I'm just kind of getting mine together. So this is kind of a first draft. Let's see here. So in that regard, I want to really thank Hugh for encouraging us all to do this. I mean, we're told in 1 Peter that we have to have this message. And so this is if we haven't done it before, this is an opportunity to put that together. And in that regard, I want to encourage others to work on that message yourselves. In my case, there are several scriptures that are very important, have been very important to me along my path. I put those on the chat also. I don't know if I'll refer to them all as I talk, but they are on the chat. And they've just been critical to answering some of my personal questions. Okay, I said I've been married three times. I was divorced after 24 years, the first one. My second marriage was to Letitia, and I was married to her 23 years, and she passed away. And 4 years after that, I met my current beautiful wife, and you know, it's amazing how these things kind of come together, and you don't expect them this to happen. And anyway, it's happened to me. So I have this wonderful wife and marriage now at this time in my life. Let me just give you a little of my background. I'm a North Dakota boy. I was born in the middle of a winter in Grandin, North Dakota, which is about 30 miles north of Fargo, right on the eastern border of North Dakota. And as you know, Fargo is often in the highlights of your news as the coldest place in the nation. Well, that's where I came from. I've got some notes here. After I was born in Grandin, I lived there until I was in about the third grade, and eventually ended up in Fargo, where I went to school and graduated. And in living in Fargo, my family did go to church, and I went through catechism. The reason I mention that is because one of the things that I learned in that catechism class stuck with me and became important later in my life. That was 1 Corinthians 13. And the important aspect of that, the important verses there that that came back to help me were First Corinthians 13, verses 12 and 13. Now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. Well, that helped me in later life to address some of my concerns. So that helped me coming out of high school. I received a Navy scholarship for 4 years, and they sent me away to college at the University of Idaho. And I continued there, and I'd had this background. Although I'd had the catechism teaching where I learned the First Corinthians 13 and some other verses, I read some more at the university. Important to me was the Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, Sermon on the Mount, and a lot of other things really going well for me. And as they were going well for me, I came to this idea that I have all these good, great things that were happening to me, but how do I know that what I believe with this biblical something, how do I know it's to be true? What could I prove of it? Was it just my imagination? How could I base my life on something I didn't know to be true? Well, and another question also that troubled me was that, what about all the people in the world without my advantages and access to biblical teachings? What standard are they held to? And their knowledge was even, opportunities were less than my own. These were two important questions to me that I couldn't resolve. I didn't resolve them until about 25 years later. In those intervening 25 years, as a result of that, I couldn't answer the questions. I dropped out of contact with the church, with many other things in my life for 25 years. I could prove nothing. I went through my military service, graduate school. My first marriage ended after 24 years. Then I married my second wife, Letitia. Who's a Christian, although herself with a troubled past, who insisted that I start to read the Bible. She was doing that. That was her habit. Like I said, we both had troubled pasts. I saw little point in it, but I didn't agree to do it. Starting in Genesis 1, I came across Genesis 15:6. I hadn't seen that before. Wow, that was an eye-opener to me. It told me, let me read that. Let's read verses, Genesis 15, verses 5 and 6. He took him outside and said, "Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." That's God speaking to Abram. He said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Next verse, Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Basically, this is my first indication that I could believe without having to prove something. It became my first indication that maybe I should have realized this before, but that this is all about faith. I can't prove it. You can't prove it. And what is important to God is that I'm righteous. I don't have to know something. God doesn't judge me on what I know. He judges us on what we believe and how we act and what we believe. And that takes me back to the verse in 1 Corinthians 13, which I read earlier, that about now we see but a poor reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face, presumably, as we pass on. Now I know in part, that's what we're given knowledge now, knowing in part, then I shall know even as I am fully known. So I tried putting these things together. And so it gave me permission to believe, actually. And that was the start. Of my road back. We had no proof of the biblical message, but we have evidences of it. God does not provide us proof. He does not expect us to know, he expects us to believe. That is central to the Christian message. So that, you see, is the turning point that I'm referring to. I came to this point of thinking that there was nothing in the Bible for me. And I read that one verse. It really kind of turned me around. So Letitia and I were married, and as I read that, then I that really that opened my eyes to the Bible and so many things. It gained my interest. And as you say that you believe, then you can actually you open yourself up to understanding more. You then gain more understanding in your reading. Now, I guess the next aspect is, okay, so here we were on this new path. But it turned out that Letitia, my wife, became sick early in our marriage. And the first sickness was schizophrenia. And how to deal with that? I mean, it took us years to figure out how to deal with that, to get her on medications that she would accept. And then these medications, and then along with that came other illnesses, physical illnesses. So she became really functionally almost fully disabled, probably for the last, I don't know, 15 years of her life. And along with this, I would have to say that, you know, during this period of time, we were going to this church in Hermosa Beach. And the one thing that she could do, you know, she understood that she had interest. She knew a lot about the Bible. So we would go down to the Bible classes. And that's one thing that she could fully participate in. And I could also, and learned a lot. That's where I really started to learn get my understanding of the Bible. And and the result of that, it was amazing that even with her disability, we really had a wonderful life. So that is kind of the second virtue here, the second lesson here, is that how that could happen. She had tremendous health issues that during this time that she'd walked away from the house one night with her schizophrenia. She was attacked on the beach. She contracted HIV. Which now I had to, she had to deal with her diabetes at that time with injections, with the syringes, of course, which themselves became infected, and which I was, injured with twice and had to take a series of medications. It turns out that if you know that you're exposed to the HIV, And quickly, you can take a series of medications that will interfere with it. And so I did that. I had to do that twice. And the I think that's the probably the extent of my testimony is that, in spite that there's 3 points. One is that we, all of us do have this testimony that we can develop and share. And in some cases, it can be powerful. And and we often we don't have a lot more than that to share. There's that, and there's the idea of what turned my life around, that this reading this one scriptural verse that led to many other things. And then how, even after all these, with all these years, that I should clarify, I hope I clarified this one thing. She got the HIV from her attack on the beach. We found that out almost immediately because she had to go to the hospital. I took her immediately to the hospital because of her, and they determined that infection in the hospital. So that was, we could deal with that. And then the surprising thing is that with all those issues that we did have a marriage that was great. Okay, with that, I guess that's what I have to say. Oh, excuse me now. I got one more thing here now. So I do have my current marriage, and Marianne, my wife, is going to tell us a little bit about that.
Hello, everybody. You got to get 2-for-1 here. I just wanted to say that I really appreciate God introducing me to Norman, and I'm taking on a little bit. I'm not going to talk long, just a tiny bit, from Philippians 1:12 from our study that you gave us, Dr. Ross. Now, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has actually served to advance the gospel. Norman was in a chorus group, Angel City Chorale. And in that chorus group, he knew my friend. Her name is Joyce. So Joyce and Norman went to lunch one day, and but she said that, and she told me, she said, Marianne, you know, he's not really for me, but I think that he'll, I think that he'll be for you. I'd like for you to meet him, and if it's agreeable to both of you, then would you be willing? And I said, okay, and Norman said, okay, and so we all went to lunch together. And so after the lunch, Norman was leaving for South Africa because he knows a gentleman there. He's director of an organization, AMI. It was then AMI Beale Foundation, which now it's AMI Foundation, which helps children in townships with after-school activities. So he went there after their season of Angel City, and we were, he said that he would be interested in seeing me again, and I said I would too. Neither of us were looking for anyone, you know, we weren't, you know, I had gone through so many things in my life, so many failed times, and just, you know, I won't even go into that, because that's not part of my testimony, this is, but so I wasn't looking for anyone, and Norman, I think he was enjoying his freedom, traveling, and you know, staying months at a time, because he was in South Africa for 2 months. So I waited for him to get back for 2 months. And then chorus practice started again. And so when chorus practice started again for the next season, Joyce saw Norman and she went up and she said, oh, Norman, you know, Marianne says, if you want to, you guys can go out again. So he said, okay, have Marianne email me or go. Not what's her number, but have Marianne email me or telephone me, and then, you know, we'll set it up. So I did, being the bold person I am, I called him, And so he said, okay, we'll go out, but Joyce can't come. I'm like, okay, that's all right. So we went out, and we were like inseparable for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, I moved in, seeing that he needed a lot of help around the house and things. So I moved in, and at the time I was with my daughter and granddaughter, my grandchildren, excuse me. So we moved in, and then right after that, he asked me to marry him, and I had to get a lot of things together, and I guess he had a few things to also get together. So we were married a year later. So I just want to say that in that year, Norman has started going to my church, because that was one of the conditions he had to go. I really appreciate our pastor, Pastor Adam Edgerly. And I really appreciated him. And Norman was going to church with me and really enjoyed his teaching. And then I met Dr. Ross and the whole class, and I enjoy that. And it was something that I could add to an arsenal of helping people understand about Christianity and God and the universe. And, you know, I'm not real smart on that, but you know, the things that I do understand, I really, really appreciate. And I appreciate Norman. And I just wanted to say that part, because Norman always tells a story a different way. So I wanted to tell my part, because my part is more accurate, because I was on the side, you know, that's my side of the story. So thank you.
I wanted to mention, Norm didn't mention that you have a PhD in chemistry from Caltech. Is that right?
Norman.
That's close. Chemical engineering.
Yeah.
Engineering from Caltech.
Yeah, Norman does. I'm just high school. So anyway, thank you all. And thank you, Dr. Ross, too. I really appreciate you. And I wanted to let you know that.
Well, thank you. Thank you for bringing your wife in on this, Norm. Very much appreciate that. Appreciate, too, your emphasis on how, you know, God gives us evidence, and we need to act upon it. We need to believe it. And we do. He gives us more knowledge, more understanding, more knowledge. We never come up with absolute proof, but he keeps giving us assurances and evidences that he's there offering our life and guiding us into ministry. And also appreciate you bringing up Philippians 1:12, because that's kind of where we're going from Romans 8:28. So what I'm going to do now is share screen again and set us up for our discussion time. As I look at the clock, we're about time to go there. So let me quickly get that set up. So okay.
He said three. Each will give a 3-minute.
The passages we've been going through. Let me just quickly zip through these slides here. Get up to where we are. Here's the Romans 8:28 passage. The discussion questions we developed for our web meeting, and this is what Paul says. The verse that you quoted. Philippians 1:12, what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. And I promised last week that I would give a quick story on how this has happened in my life. And, when I've been overseas, there have been several times when I've been invited to speak at a university where the audience that gathers there is so upset and angry about the Christian faith, they just immediately start screaming and yelling and won't even let me speak. And, they try to shut down the meeting. And that's only happened to me once in the United States. And it happened when I was speaking at the University of Buffalo. And I was kind of ready for this in the sense that I was well aware that there's a half dozen atheist organizations that are headquartered in Buffalo. So I was expecting it to be, but I thought the audience would be predominantly students and professors. What I discovered later after I had my event there is that the atheists are so aggressive in the city of Buffalo that they'll basically go to any event where anyone tries to promote the Christian faith, and they'll do their best to disrupt it. And they got to be such an annoyance that students and faculty basically stopped going to Christian-sponsored events on the campus. And so, but I quickly realized, you know, this is not your normal university audience. There are all these people, mostly men, and mostly younger men, and all very angry. I could tell they were angry even before I took the podium there and started to speak. But that's what happened. They immediately started screaming and yelling at the top of their lungs and, you know, refused to let me speak. And I said, how am I going to handle this? And I said, well, you know, what is it that's making you most disturbed about the message I'm going to give here? How about if I just not speak and go to just deal with the questions that you have? And so I had to deal with a lot of really angry questions that they were posing to me. But I wound up doing a Q&A time that lasted for 2 hours. And what I noticed is the longer we went into that Q&A time, number one, the Q&A just started off with them making the most egregious charges against me. They were swearing at me, accusing me of all kinds of very unchristian behavior. And I basically said, okay, I got a question for you. Obviously, you've met Christians that have been very abusive towards you. Can you kind of give me an account of one of them that just disturbed you the most? And I heard these stories and then began to try to help them. Okay, you know, would you be interested in what the Bible has to say about how we should respond when we're in those situations? And they said, and they made all kinds of crass statements of the Bible, but opened up a dialogue. And it was about an hour and a half into the Q&A where I began to see the mood change a little bit. They began to soften. And a lot of them would come up and say, look, I want to talk to you afterwards, but I want to talk to you privately. And after the 2 hour Q&A, I stayed another 2 hours just talking with the people that were gathered there individually, one-on-one, kind of take them off to a corner and talk to them. And discovered that at the end of that evening, basically it was the first time they ever met a public Christian who was willing to be patient and compassionate towards them. And they said, we'd never met anybody like that before. And the stories they told of me, how they'd been abused. I said, well, you were presuming that these people who abused you were Christians because they said so. Have you ever actually looked at what the Bible says as a test of someone as a true follower of the God that created the universe? And that really opened up a lot of doors because they were recognizing these people who we thought were followers of Jesus Christ really were not followers of Jesus Christ. They were wolves in sheep's clothing. I actually went into those passages. Bottom line is, just the abuse that I took for the first 30, 40 minutes I was in an auditorium, God used it in a miraculous way to open up the hearts of people who had been very hardened. And I heard later, from students on the campus, that future Christian events went in a very more positive direction than they had in the past. And I've seen that happen overseas, but to see it in the U.S., because usually when I speak in university campuses, everybody is polite, they listen. Sometimes I get abusive comments during the Q&A, but they've always allowed me to speak. This is the one and only time where they didn't allow me to speak, but it's like, it was better that I not give my message and go straight to the Q&A. So what happened to me really did serve to advance the gospel in a way that was far more effective than if I'd gone through with the message I prepared and what I was anticipating to happen. God turned it out for a remarkable good. So with that, I'm going to basically show you the URL again. This is it, because we're now at about 12:05. So I want to spend what time we got remaining in discussion. And so this is the same URL I've been using in past months. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop the webinar and all of you can join in our meeting, those of you who wish, or I'm gonna invite all of you to turn your cameras and microphones on, and we'll get into the discussion questions. And by the way, next week, we got Keith Wilson from New Zealand. I think he's the most, well, we got some people in Europe and also others in Asia to participate. But Keith gets up very early to be part of our class here. He's going to share a testimony based on Romans 8:28 or Philippians 1:12. And likewise, Clinette Carroll is going to be sharing. We've actually asked Jamie. He always shows up on our discussion time with his guitar. He never plays his guitar. But Jamie's agreed to close out our meeting today, the last minute of our meeting today, with a short guitar rendition. We got some amazing musicians that are part of the Paradoxes class. And so we asked Jamie if he could do that for us. So with that, I'm gonna close the webinar out. All of you will need to exit the webinar. You can put this URL in, that'll get you into the meeting. But please give me a couple of minutes to take you from the waiting room into the meeting. I have to do that manually, so I'm gonna need a couple of minutes to do that. So with that, let me stop the share feature here. And I'm now gonna end the meeting. I'll see all of you, and the webinar. I'll see all of you in the meeting who care to join.